This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Glynis Board. This morning, we're reflecting on how millions of opioid pills could flood a West Virginia town of 350 people.
They encouraged it by taking payoffs from my family.
They were printing out bogus prescriptions, literally, you know, one a minute at some of these pain clinics.
That and more coming up. This is West Virginia Morning. A federal judge has ruled a coal company owned by the family of West Virginia Governor Jim Justice is liable for more than 3,000 violations of federal clean water standards stemming from pollution discharged from a coal mine in southern West Virginia. Brittany Patterson has more.
In his order issued Monday, U.S. District Judge David Faber largely sided with environmental groups, ruling Bluestone Coal repeatedly violated federal clean water and mining laws at its Red Fox surface mine in McDowell County. Data submitted by the company to regulators showed dozens of violations for releasing the chemical selenium from the mine beyond established monthly and daily limits. Selenium is found in coal and has been linked to growth deformities and reproductive failure in fish. Under the Clean Water Act, each violation of a monthly average limit is treated as a violation for every day in the month, which is how Faber came up with 3,033 violations under the law. The company had tried to get the lawsuit thrown out, arguing a 2016 agreement with the EPA protected it against cases brought by environmental groups. In the ruling, the judge disagreed. If and how much the company will have to pay for its violations will be decided at trial. A request for comment from Bluestone or its lawyers was not immediately returned. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Brittany Patterson.
Today marks the one-year anniversary of the Black Jewel Railroad blockade, a two-month-long protest by unpaid miners in the eastern Kentucky coalfields. Sydney Bowles covered the protest, and now she takes us there again to reflect on what it all meant 1 year later.
It's a quiet, foggy morning by Sandhill Bottom Road in Cumberland, Kentucky. You can hear crickets chirping, birds twittering, cars passing on the highway. If you didn't know any better, you'd think this was an ordinary intersection on an ordinary stretch of mountain road. But 1 year ago, this place was far from forgettable.
No pain, no coal!
Amen!
No pain, no coal!
After the sudden and chaotic bankruptcy of Black Jewel Coal last July, hundreds of coal miners in Kentucky, Virginia, and West Virginia, and more in Wyoming, were left without jobs and without weeks of the pay they were owed. So on July 28th, five angry miners decided they weren't going to take it anymore. They stepped in front of a train full of more than $1 million worth of coal. And they didn't move for almost 2 months.
And this right here, this is BS. It has burnt us. If they can load a train out, they can give us our money.
The Black Jewel bankruptcy was a part of a larger decline in the coal market, and in the years since, that decline has only grown in speed and severity. It's left the former Black Jewel miners and other coal communities with even fewer options.
A quarter of the coal fleet has shuttered nationwide since 2005.
That's Hannah Pitt, a senior analyst at the Rhodium Group, an independent research firm that focuses on energy. The coronavirus pandemic, Pitt says, is only accelerating that decline.
In our scenarios where we're looking at what happens now that we find ourselves in this pandemic, coal is going to be hit even harder. So out to 2030, we expect more than 50% of coal plants will retire.
It's not just coal for electric power that's taking a hit, Pitt says. When the economy slows, fewer people build new things, so the market for coal used to produce steel is also in a freefall. That means a slew of hardships for coal-reliant communities, including in the employment sector. Phil Smith is a spokesperson for the United Mine Workers of America.
Early on in this in the pandemic, in March, April, and even into May, many of our members were at the mines were working short weeks. You know, they were working 2 or 3 days a week. They weren't working full shifts. Other mines were just completely furloughed.
Records from the Kentucky Energy and Environment Cabinet show that in the eastern Kentucky coal field, more than 15% of coal workers lost their job in the first quarter of 2020 alone. Some of the companies that took over Black Jewel Mines have already gone bankrupt themselves. The loss of coal jobs and tax revenue from coal companies is going to disproportionately hurt coal-reliant communities that are already struggling to make ends meet. Only time will tell how deep those wounds will be. Back at Sandhill Bottom Road, I begin to notice traces of the protest that have lasted these 12 long months. Here, some blackened stones where there might once have been a campfire. There, traces of white spray paint on the railroad, where once was written, "No pay, we stay." Most of the miners had been made whole. One former miner, Brandon Middleton, had this to say about the anniversary of the protest. Quote, "Myself and my comrades at Black Jewel lost cars, lost homes, lost retirements, and many had to leave here to seek employment far from here. The people of Appalachia have been taken advantage of by the greed of coal companies for generations, and it has to stop." For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Sydney Bowles in Cumberland, Kentucky.
The Ohio Valley Resource is made possible with support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and West Virginia Public Broadcasting. On the latest episode of West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Us and Them, host Trey Kay visits Kermit, a Mingo County town of about 350 people where 10 years ago drug companies sent 12 million hydrocodone pills. To get a deeper perspective on how that could be and how the town's doing today, Trey spoke at length with Kermit residents and investigative reporter Eric Ayer, who recently published a book on the matter. Here's an excerpt.
In the beginning, Kermit was a quintessential coal town. Eric Ayer is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter, formerly of the Charleston Gazette-Mail.
Kermit's got, you know, steep hills, and you've got a river that runs through it, and you've got railroad that runs directly through town, shakes your houses when you're sitting at home and when the trains come by, when the coal trains come by. Mingo County, probably people know it's the birthplace of the Hatfield and McCoy feud.
Yep, you heard that right. This is where the Hatfield family of West Virginia spent decades feuding with the McCoys of Kentucky. But there's another thing that's made Kermit infamous.
It seems like every couple of years there's some sort of scandal regarding corruption, voter fraud, or kickbacks or bribery, that sort of thing.
And Debbie and the Priest family have been involved in a lot of it. In the late 1980s, some members of the Priest family sold weed and cocaine. At the time, Debbie was a member of the city council and married to the chief of police. Her father was the fire chief. But after a big undercover drug bust involving the FBI, more than 50 people went to jail, including many members of the Priest family.
You know, I'm not Lily White. I have a bad history, and something very tragic happened to our family. I mean, it was no secret that my family was doing it, and because of the payoffs and the money, you know, everybody just turned a blind eye. And I felt like they encouraged it by turning a blind eye and taking payoffs from my family.
As the coal economy in this part of West Virginia slowed down, drugs have played a defining role. 40 years ago, it was illegal drugs. More recently, it's been prescription painkillers. Kermit has made national news at the height of the opioid crisis, when it was flooded with pills. In 6 years, from 2006 to 2012, pharmaceutical distributors sent 780 million hydrocodone and oxycodone pills to West Virginia. In 3 years, 12 million hydrocodone pills were shipped by various drug distributors into Kermit. And in a two-year period, drug distributors sent nearly 9 million prescription opioid pills to Kermit. All of that in a town of about 350 people. The painkillers that once made it possible for miners to keep on working were now being overprescribed and abused. It didn't take long for all those pills to take a toll. In 2016, one of Debbie Priest's 13 siblings, William Bull Priest, died from an oxycodone overdose. 2 years later, her brother Timmy Dale also OD'd. Debbie vowed that her brother's deaths would not be viewed as just another overdose. Reporter Eric Ayer wanted to know how a tight-knit town like Kermit became the epicenter for opioids. As he dug into the story, he uncovered a world of corruption and pills and families being torn apart. Eric's reporting resulted in a Pulitzer Prize and a new book, Death in Mudlick. Mudlick is a small community where Bull lived. The book is about the Priest family and how Kermit has been flooded with opioids. The first question Eric wanted to answer is, how could this happen?
It happened with a number of different groups getting together, taking part in it. You had the manufacturers who were advertising the drugs as non-addictive. You had the distributors who were just shipping the drugs from the manufacturing facilities to warehouses and then to pharmacies. You had the pharmacists that were dispensing the drugs, and you had the doctors who were running something called pain pill clinics, which were basically fronts for just a massive distribution of prescriptions.
At its peak, Kermit was getting more than 31,000 pills for every person who lived in the town. How could no one have noticed this in such a small town? Debbie Priest says people knew.
I don't think it was unnoticed. I don't know how it could have been unnoticed unless you just buried your head in the sand. I knew there was a problem just by the traffic and the people going to these doctors and me knowing people and them talking to me. I don't know, maybe because I was a worldly person and I knew, and a lot of people trusted me and talked to me and came to me for help a lot. But I don't know how you could not have known it.
Remember how Debbie described Kermit earlier, with only one post office, one restaurant, no traffic lights, and a pharmacy? It was called Save Right. That very pharmacy filled tens of thousands of prescriptions. Prescriptions that weren't always legitimate.
There were about 70 different places across the state of West Virginia called pain clinics. A number of them were just sham clinics. They had doctors that were affiliated with the facilities, but they weren't necessarily there. Here in Charleston, we had one that I drove by every day for lunch. We got a report about what was going on there, and they would have these facilities where you had ex-cops working at them. They were taking blood pressure and temperatures of patients, but the doctors weren't even there, and they were printing out bogus prescriptions by literally, you know, one a minute at some of these pain clinics. As long as you paid in cash, you'd get a prescription, and then they would steer you to a particular pharmacy that would fill that prescription.
Eric found out people would come to that Save Right pharmacy from Ohio, Virginia, Kentucky, Pennsylvania, and even Florida and Flint, Michigan, to get their prescriptions filled. And that's where the traffic that Debbie mentioned comes in.
It got so bad at one point that they people were complaining about the waits to get their prescription opioids. So the owner of the pharmacy, Jim Uli, he set up a camper trailer on the site and started selling hot dogs and hamburgers and soda pop.
That sounds like a county fair or something like that.
Yeah, and then inside they had, they had hot buttered popcorn inside.
When you see cars that are backing up far on the highway, and I guess there's trailers outside, doesn't anybody around there raise a suspicion? Doesn't the state police, do they drive by and ask what's going on here?
Well, first off, the local police in Kermit, they only had one police officer, the police chief, so he wasn't going to do anything. And then the local, they have a Mingo County Sheriff's Department, but a lot of their officers had connections. There, in one case, one of the chief deputies of the Mingo County Sheriff's Department, his wife was a farm tech at the pharmacy. So they certainly weren't going to do anything.
We've been listening to an excerpt from the latest episode of our show, Us and Them, titled Recovery and Resiliency in Kermit. To hear the rest of the show, download Us and Them wherever you get your podcasts or listen online at wvpublic.org. This episode of Us and Them is presented with support from the Claude Worthington Benedum Foundation and the West Virginia Humanities Council. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from West Virginia University, Concord University, and Shepherd University. Our news director is Andrea Billups. I'm your producer and host, Glynis Ford. This is West Virginia Morning.